This was the biggest, greatest edge in the history of gambling edges, I can promise you. But I've never uttered this in public to anyone ever before.
You want
to
nuke it?
Yeah.
Let's nuke it.
I feel like I can rule the world. I know I could be what I want to. I put my all in it like no days off.
All right, so, so we got to tell your story back. Because your story is, you basically did what me and probably 50% of other young guys wanted to do in their life. It's like, oh, what if I could take a few $1,000s, find an edge, beat the house in Vegas, and turn a few $1,000s into millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars, and ultimately, I believe, over hundreds of millions of dollars, not by counting cards in blackjack, first by sports betting. And then you get recruited by Mark Cuban to go work for an NBA team at one point. You now own your own soccer club. So you've had this like really cool life and career.
You're like a comic book character.
Yeah, you're like your man cave came to life, you know, like it worked. Yeah. So that's dope. But, you know, of course, no story is perfect. You know, there's ups and downs, and it's not like you planned it out this way. But what we like most on this podcast is mostly a business podcast. So somebody comes on and they tell us about their company or their investments or whatever. And, what we like most is people who play their own game. What I like about you is you play your own game. You're a pretty independent thinker. And so I want to kind of walk through the story. So, you know, what I'll call chapter one is stumbling into gambling and figuring out how to have that edge. Can you tell a little bit about that story? Cause Sam, I think I know a little bit of it, but I know Sam, you don't know any of that story, right? Like how he first got and made a name for himself doing this.
No.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up around gambling. My dad was, I use the term unsuccessful gambler. Some people might refer to it as degenerate. He was someone who gambled a lot unsuccessfully and, caused a lot of problems in our family. Not to sugarcoat it, was bad. But I grew up around the horse racetrack and I grew up around watching football, NFL football on Sunday, basically trying to like help my dad make picks.
What city?
I grew up in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. So I was at the Assiniboia Downs racetrack every Saturday, Sunday, Wednesday for most of my teenage years. I would say 12 to 16, 17, 18. I just kind of was around. That's how I kind of, and I always thought it was rather interesting. And I also saw like, first thing I didn't realize when I was younger was just how it was near impossible to beat the horses just because of the takeout. The vig is so high. It's like 30, 36%. They got to pay for everything, the stables, the horse pools, you know, all of it. But I just thought, well, these people don't know what they're doing. Like they have no process. They don't know what's happening. They're very emotional. Like I'm in a Greek family. So you would hear these people, like they just were not in control of their emotions in any way. They would be upset when they win. They'd be upset when they lose. They would be arguing with each other. I'm very low key. So to me, it was very different for me.
You don't become the world's most valuable women's sports franchise by accident. Angel City Football Club did it with a little help from HubSpot. When they started, data was housed across multiple systems. HubSpot unified their website, email marketing, and fan experience in one platform. This allowed their small team of three to build an entire website in just 3 days. The results were nearly 350 new signups a week and 300% database growth in just 2 years. Visit HubSpot.com to hear how HubSpot can help you grow better. All right, back to the pod.
So that's how I got started. And then at some point after I graduated from high school, I went to Vegas with my dad. He was there. And I went there for like a month or so.
He was
like
there gambling?
He was there. My dad was, it was daylight hours. And he had money in his pocket. He was gambling.
What was his occupation?
He was a first generation. He moved to Canada when he was. He's got a great. You should have him on the show. He's got a great story. He moved to Canada when he was like 20 years old. Didn't speak a lick of English. Became a dishwasher at Kentucky Fried Chicken, and just worked his ass off. And so he moved his way up from dishwasher to restaurant to finally getting involved in real estate somehow, by some way, owning a commercial development. He had strip malls all over Winnipeg.
So he's an entrepreneur.
Big time entrepreneur, yes.
Wow. And when you go to Vegas, you're not 21, right? You just graduated from high school. So what do you do with your dad? You're in a casino. You can't really do much.
I park myself in the sports book and hope that nobody tells me.
Because they don't ID you in the sports book. Yeah,
you just sit there. They're supposed to, but they don't. Like, you're just in the sports book. So you're just sitting there, you know, and I just watch basketball. It was like the first time I really ever watched NBA basketball to that extent. I was watching a lot of hockey and and Canadian football. And yeah, my dad would give me a little bit of money, not a lot. And I would watch basketball and I would sit there from 4 p.m. Pacific to 10 p.m., 11 p.m. Pacific and just watch the games on these giant TVs. And then I started to really enjoy the routine of watching the West Coast games. So I started to like kind of pay attention more to the West Coast teams. I was like Chris Webber's rookie year when he played for Golden State. And they had run TMC, I think it was, before that. And so, yeah, that's what I did.
Were you losing money at first? Or what was going on? When did you start making money?
I didn't really win. I wasn't losing a lot, though. Like, I had an okay opinion by the end. But, yeah, I was losing, of course. Like, I was probably flipping coins and paying big. So I was, like, probably 50-50 roughly, but I needed to win 11 to 10. I had 11 out of every 10. So it wasn't bad. It wasn't like I was getting my ass handed to me or anything. But then I realized I really like this and I want to get good at it. And then I just thought about what does that entail? What do I have to do to get good at it? And so I just went to work and just started taping games to start reading a lot of newspaper articles on the internet.
When you're saying you're learning to get good at it, how much of it is a human side where you're like learning human emotions of like the players and leadership and things like that and like the story versus statistics?
Yeah, back then there was not a lot of good statistics. There was just there's just something called the box score, which is just not very illustrative of the game. So it was almost that and a little bit of database work in terms of like just getting aggregates from teams in certain situations. I also tried to like really also understand the market more, I think. In other words, the opening lines would always, what I got to be really good when I was in Vegas around that time was seeing the sharps that would line up at the Stardust Casino in the morning. They had something called a lottery. So the lines would be posted in the morning. And then every sharp would be able to make a full limit bet down in the morning. And they'd have to do a lottery to see who could go first. And then they'd make a bet and then the book would decide to adjust. So I started just like looking to see like, okay, who are the actual sharps? Who are the guys who seem like they're moving money for other people? What are they betting?
So you're treating it like a job. You must have been getting there early then. What time is that?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a lot of work. It's not manual labor. I'm not like laying bricks or like riding off the back of a brontosaurus like Fred Flintstone breaking rocks, but yeah, it would work.
And so did you go ask them to learn from them or are you just watching them from afar and figuring it out yourself?
I just wanted to see like, okay, this guy made a bet. The line didn't move. That's interesting. Then you see him back like the next day and the next day. And then you see by the way, it wouldn't just be one. You'd see like at 4 o'clock post time, the lines would move even more. So it's like, okay, this line moved a lot. There wasn't an injury. That guy bet it early. So it was just like little things. Like I think if I have one skill in life aside from being not really caring what other people who I don't know think about me, I think, and just being confident in that, I think it's like maybe like a little bit of pattern recognition. I think I'm decent at that. I think I can see patterns. And I'm also able to identify like, oh, was that an actual pattern or was I just fooling myself with randomness there?
Did you have a role model? Like was there, as an 18 or 19 year old, are you thinking to yourself, there are other people who have gotten super rich doing this. I think I can do it. Or were you like, there's some people who make an okay living doing this. I think I can do it. Or you're like, I don't think about next year. This is what I'm enjoying today.
When you're 19, you don't really think like that. I don't like in terms of like, oh, I want to make a, I've always been someone who's always like been very confident that I was going to be successful. I would recite things in my head when I was a kid, like I'm going to be a millionaire. I would just do that. And so at that age, I think I was just kind of, I wasn't sure how I was going to make it. I just knew I was going to make it. Like I kind of went through life with this like irrational confidence, I think.
Was there a definition of making it? Was it like $10 million by the time I'm 25?
Yeah, I think when I was tree planting, I was listening to like Tony Robbins books and reading them, like listening to them at night and then reading them in the morning. And I think, yeah, I had like 10 things that I wanted I think it was 10 million before the age of 30, I think. Back then that was a lot of money. Now you can just spin up a meme coin and you're make it by noon. But back then it was a lot.
What was the first profitable pattern you figured out? The one that really kind of worked?
Canadian football. My first bit of money was Canadian football, not like soccer, but actual like football, three down football. There's a lot of things going on. Then there was, they expanded into America at that time. And so you had some interest for whatever reason in Las Vegas to book Canadian Football League games or like offshore markets. And so, and the Canadian teams had to abide by different rules than the American teams. So that was part of it. You had to have a certain amount of Canadians on your roster that were starting. American teams didn't have that. The Canadian stadiums were all compliant to Canadian Football League rules. American stadiums did not. So some of the end zones, like the Canadian rules are like the end zones are 20 yards deep. But in some stadiums in America, they didn't have that luxury. So they were like squared off at the back. And so those games were lower scoring. That was a big part of it. And I just got to be really good at knowing a lot about Canadian football and which teams were sharp, were doing innovative things. So Canadian football.
So can you give us a sense of the kind of the journey? So you start with a roughly what bankroll? And then how long did it take you to get to your first million? And then at one point, I think you were betting like $1 million a day, or maybe even more than that. Somebody said $10 million a day.
I mean, I was betting a lot. I mean, I think like, so it's a long story. So I think the most, it got to be, I was a sky cap at the Winnipeg International Airport. That's when things really took off for me. And I don't think anyone's ever said that before in their life.
What
is a sky cap?
I was like the first white sky cap hired at the Winnipeg. I was like the dudes who sit curbside and carry people's luggage in and check their luggage in. In the US, they check the luggage in, but in Canada, that's not allowed because of transport Canada. So you would just carry people's luggage in. So I would like carry
like
luggage
a bag
in.
Boy.
We don't like being called bag boys.
Bag man.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. So you're just carrying people's luggage. Or in Canada, a big thing in the winter was snowbirds who are fleeing Winnipeg to go move to Florida for the winter. And they're in wheelchairs, and you're just like wheeling them through customs and immigration and making sure they're bags.
And you're making what per hour roughly?
I was making a lot. So I started out as a sky cap. In the summertime, I was printing money. And I started out as a sky cap. I realized that the Saturday, Sunday shifts were very profitable because we had American fishing travel that where people would come in on these boats and they'd have to take a charter plane to go fishing somewhere in northern Canada. And those days you're making $400 or $500 in an 8-hour shift, easy.
Wow.
And so I basically went to the boss of the company. He's like, hey, I really want to work the Saturday and Sunday shifts. What do I got to do to make it happen? He's like, no, we got to spread those around. It's not fair. And the other dudes weren't making any money. They would make like $80. So I just started paying them for their Saturday. I started paying them like $80 to work Saturday and Sunday. And then the owner got wind of that and he got upset. And so then he started working the Saturdays and Sundays and couldn't figure out why he wasn't making money that I was, but I was
What were you doing? You were like complimenting these folks and just getting tipped?
I was just like, I was doing things like getting them limos to go to the strip clubs when the 4 hours that they're getting them Cuban cigars because Cuban cigars are legal when they land and like making sure they had like Cuban cigars and charging them like 3 times the value for that. Just like little things like that.
Yeah, just being attentive.
I was being attentive. I was like a concierge of the Winnipeg International Airport. But then, anyways, I ended up taking over the company from him. I just undercut his contracts. And so there was actually, at the Winnipeg International Airport, I was making so much money.
That's an easy leap, right? Bag boy to taking, it's like you just walk in his office actually, and you're like, hey, guy, move.
I went to him and I was like, yo, like I've already got it was Northwest Airlines, now Delta, I guess, but it was Northwest. I was like, hey, I've already got them to agree to the contract. Everyone wants to work for me. I can give you some money and you can just move on, or I can just undercut you. The money I'm going to give you, I'm going to say, it's a win-win. And he was like, nope, don't want to do that. Whatever. So I ended up doing that. I ended up undercutting him.
So how old are you?
I was 22, 23 time. There's actually a crazy story. So I was making so much money at the Winnipeg International Airport as a sky cap and gambling, that mostly sky cap, that at the time, there was some cocaine that was found in Air Canada. I had like a pass to go everywhere as a sky cap. And there was like a situation where some drugs were found, like big amount of drugs from like, and one of the US Customs and Immigration employees who I became friends with said like, hey, they think you're like, we know what you're doing here as a sky cap and I know you, but you're like suspect number one. Like, just so you know, they don't understand why you have a brand new Cadillac, whatever, not brand new, but like you're driving a Cadillac, like some gangster, and you're walking around with wads of cash. Like I had lots of cash from the salt tips. And so I was like, what? And he's like, yeah, like they were laughing. They thought it was funny. They realized, of course, it had nothing to do with it, but you can Google this. So it actually happened. There's like some kind of thing that happened in Winnipeg at the time where they found something.
So what was your income at the age of 22, 23, 24 doing all this?
Like 50 or 60,000 a summer easily. I was living with my mom and my older brother. We were like paying my parents' rent for a while after my dad kind of had like a down slope on during the 1987 or whatever, the interest rates went up. Strip mall business wasn't so good anymore, especially when you're borrowing money to at floating rates to build these strip malls. So yeah, that was about what I was making at the time.
So you've been rich since you were 23 years old.
Oh, I don't think so, because I've been spending, I wasn't exactly saving. Like money was going, I was like going out for dinner every night. I was like spending the money. It was taking trips to Vegas. I was doing stuff. But yeah, I had to pay for my school also. I had to pay for my university. So I was paying for my university. I was supporting my parents. So I wasn't rich. I just worked hard. I also, while I was working at Sky Cup, I also worked as a video store at Rogers Video. I was working 40 hours a week at Rogers Video in the summer. Skycap in the morning and Rogers Video, which is like a Canadian Blockbuster. So I had a work ethic, I guess.
You're more of a hustler than I thought. I don't know. The public perception is you're like kind of just a sharp. It's all mental. You sit in your room, you have your models, and then you make bets and the money comes in. I didn't know at least some of these stories about you kind of hustling as the sky cap and figuring out how to like run your own operation down there. So that's pretty cool. When did, I don't know, Sam, if you've heard these stories, but I guess a couple of your famous betting stories are, I guess you went all in at one point on the Lakers to win the championship and at six to one odds.
Yeah, 6.5 to 1 roughly.
How much is all in, and what age in the timeline?
It was like 87,000 Canadian, give or take.
And that was all your money?
Yeah, but you could go buy. I looked at it like, okay, it was all my money now. It's like October. Fishing season just ended at Winnipeg International Airport. I've already paid for my tuition at the University of Manitoba to get my useless philosophy degree. I'm living in my brother's basement. Worst case, I lose this bet and I just go back to skycapping and just make half of that or 2/3 of that back again. So I made the bet. It wasn't a sharp bet by any stretch. Looking back, it wasn't sharp, but it felt sharp to me at the time. You don't have your risk model hasn't developed, your amygdala or whatever hasn't fully developed to you're that age to really understand if you're making good decisions. So,
did he win?
Yeah, he won. Yeah.
Sam, have you heard the Bill Burr quote about risk?
No. What's he say?
The comedian. He has this great line about risk, because being a comedian is like, it's risky in many levels, right? You're probably not going to be a successful, famous, millionaire, traveling, touring comedian. But on top of that, just stepping on the stage is a risk. You're going to get humiliated most of the time when you're not that funny. And he goes, somebody asked him, how was it taking that risk? Taking on that risk, taking that leap of faith. And he goes, I didn't see it as a risk. He goes, the best thing that ever happened to me, he's like, I'm kind of dumb, but the one smart thing I realized early on was the risk was waking up in a king-size bed when I'm 40 years old, turning over to a woman that I don't love anymore, that I'm married because I thought it was the right thing to do, dreading this job I have to go to in 6 hours. And he's like, that became the risk in my head, was waking up like that. And he goes, chasing your dream, there's no risk at all. He goes,
yeah.
He goes, there's no risk in chasing your dream, because you're doing the thing you want to do and versus living this life that you don't want to live just to play it safe. That seemed like a bigger risk.
Definitely relate to that. I mean, I don't know if any of you guys had the pleasure of spending a winter in Winnipeg, but it's not pleasant. So
one of the other stories then that's pretty sweet is I guess at one point, like in Vegas, you can bet on the full game, which is what most people do. Like me, I'm a casual. I go in, I just bet on the over under, maybe on the final score. And what he realized was like, you could also bet on the first half only, which was like not as common of a bet. But the way that Vegas was doing it is they would take the full score, which they were pretty accurate at predicting, and then for the halftime score, they would just cut in half, divide by two.
Roughly. Make the first half a little bit higher scoring in general. I could tell you guys, I haven't told this. I tell this story in a way that makes it so the edge still lives on for the people that are still betting. But I don't
you
know.
You want to nuke it?
You guys caught
Let's
me out.
Let's nuke it.
All right, folks, this is a quick plug for a podcast called I Digress. If you're trying to grow your business but feel like you're drowning in buzzwords and BS, then check out the I Digress podcast. It's hosted by this guy named Troy Sandage. He's helped launch over 35 brands that drive $175 million in revenue. So if you want to get smarter about scaling your business, listen to I Digress wherever you get your podcasts. All right, back to the pod.
Okay, this will maybe go viral. I don't know. Probably fuck up a lot of people's money. But most people have figured it out by now. But I've never uttered this in public to anyone ever before. True story. Okay. The away team gets to choose which basket it wants to shoot on, oriented. So you have teams who play. Back then, I would say 30 teams in the NBA, 28 of them, 27 of them, when they're on the road, would always want their offense shooting in front of their own bench, and they would want their defense shooting in front of their bench in the second half. Therefore, the first halves are higher scoring, the second halves are lower scoring. You've got the bench in front of you. You can bark out instructions, this and that. Three coaches, God bless them, I wouldn't be here without them, decided that they wanted to flip it, and they wanted to have the defense in front of them in the first half. And in the second half, they wanted to randomize the game and make the second halves higher scoring. So you would literally, like Eddie Jordan, Jerry Sloan was the king of this. He was the first original guy from Utah. And so this was the biggest, greatest edge in the history of gambling edges, I can promise you. You would have situations where the total would be higher in the first half, lower in the second half, and the team would literally score on average 106 points in the first half and 87 or something like this, or 90, whatever it was back then in the second half. You also have the advantage of fouling at the end of games, which will also make the score in the second half higher scoring, and overtime, which is a nice little bonus too, working in your favor. So the second half over was like, you'd have teams playing, doing this 41 times a year, and they would go 9 overs in the first half, 30 whatever, 32, 33 with some pushes in the second half. And you could just print money making this bet. And that's what I did. And I figured that out very, very quickly. Actually, I didn't figure it out that quickly. To be honest, I'm not as bright as I think I am, because it took me a long time to figure out what the fuck was happening. I just knew these teams had situations where on the road, their games were much lower scoring in the first half than they were when they played at home. And I thought, well, they're trying to slow the game down. It's this and that. But really, it's just you're more efficient when your offense is in front of your bench, because the other team's defense can't get set and you can bark out instructions.
But that seems like a clear pattern, right? Like, you'd only need a season of games to understand that pattern.
Well, you don't know that teams are doing this. Not like they say, hey, the Mavericks are shooting in front of their, like, they're the one team. Nobody's paying attention to this. Nobody knows that a team that back then it was a perfect situation, because it was 3 to 4 teams a year. They were all shit teams. It was, in my heyday, it was the Utah Jazz, who was a shit team. The Washington Wizards with Eddie Jordan, shit team. Byron Scott, New Jersey Nets, shit team. And then you had a few teams like the Minnesota Timberwolves did it some games, not other games, which is the dream scenario nowadays. That's probably screwing these gamblers, because when that happens, you've... So that was it. That was the edge. That's how I made a lot of my money. And you could... If I had a bankroll of... This is not responsible. Please don't follow this. But if I had a bankroll of like 250K, because I was betting on credit, you settle at the end of the week, I'd have a situation where if I somehow lost all my bets, I'd be like $2 or $3 million in debt. But it didn't matter, because I knew my edge was so big that I was betting, and I somehow partnered up with some big bookmaker / alleged mafia guy in Montreal, which is another story, who was able to get me down for a lot of money. And he just basically, I gave him the bets. I told him what I wanted to bet. He would go bet them for me. He'd collect. He'd give me the money. I'd win. And that was that. So that's the edge. That's the whole edge in a nutshell.
This is insane. I have so many questions, but you know, I'm a new...
I don't want to tell this. I've had like friends who I've told this to are like, oh, can you please share that on my podcast with me? I'm like, I feel bad for the people who are still grinding out a living doing this. But you know what? It's a new day. Tariffs are here. This is my tariff to the gambling community.
I'm a new fan of yours. You know, Sean was like, we got to talk to this guy. So I'm a new fan. So I went and read everything I could in the past week. Can you give some type of... Can you give me, a noob, some type of scale as to your winnings? Like, are we talking like hundreds of millions of dollars in winnings, or whatever you're comfortable with?
Yeah, no. I mean, look, I made between $10 to $12 million a year gambling for 10 to 15 years minimum.
So we're talking nine figures in winnings.
But I spent a lot. Like, I didn't just always. That was like my net win. You know, I'm not talking about local. I won, but I lost. I mean, like, I lived a pretty good life. Like, I took care of my parents. I did other things. But yeah, I profited a lot gambling on basketball for sure. Like, a bad year for me on the NBA, I think it was like $6 or $7 million. Average year is probably 8. And in the early heydays, I made more money than I. But I was also, I made some mistakes afterwards. But yeah,
but were you in your personal life? Are you living a life of a 28-year-old rich guy? Of like, I mean, are you spending 7 figures a year? in personal, like,
not
that crazy.
But I did other business. I tried like other business things. I like, you know, I helped out some family. I bought like a property in Montreal. I bought, you know, some stuff for my,
So you kind of overplay. You're, it doesn't seem like you're being irresponsible.
No, I was just like, I just think life is short and what's the point of having money if you can't spend it. So, but I don't spend it. I spend it on experience. I spend it on experiences. Like, I'm not a flashy guy. I don't drive a fancy car. I don't wear jewelry. I've never had a watch. I've never had any expensive, you know, I'm pretty basic in my clothing.
Just like a lot of NBA players like end up going broke, or NFL players end up going broke in their like later career. One of the crazy things about like, I grew up idolizing Phil Ivey and a lot of poker guys basically. And once I got into the world of business and investing, it's like, okay, this was kind of like what real wealth looks like. And I realized that a lot of the guys who were really great poker players, really great gamblers that you thought were really great gamblers, like, I don't think they were as successful.
Like businessmen.
As I thought. Yeah. Like, you know, I don't think they made as much in their peak. And I think they lost a lot along the way, or they had huge downswings somewhere along the way. As far as you know, are you the most, like, did you do the best? Are you the most successful sports bettor that you know, or were there people better than you that made more than you?
Billy Walters is Billy Walters had the biggest, like, my edge was, I had to like scrap for my edge but Billy Walters had the first computer program when, like, they were using giant, like, these old Westinghouse machines to feed the information on those giant cards for computer programming. And they had like a computer program when the Vegas odds makers would just sit there and like sit around a table. Like, I think the line should be 7.5. What do you think, Jack? And I think it should be around 8.5. And then like Billy Walters computer guy is like, no, it's like 4.3 is the right price on this game. So they had like the best edge ever. He made a lot of money, super successful.
And Billy Walters, I think I saw a 60 Minute special on him. Is he the, he's a Southern guy? Yeah, I read about him. I saw the 60 Minute, and he was exactly like I thought he was going to be. Like, he seemed like a fast talking, wheeling and dealing.
No, not a fast talker. He opposite. The number one thing Billy Walters had going for him is he's from the South, and if you're a gambler, one of the greatest things you can have going for you is people thinking you're not as intelligent as you actually are.
I guess I shouldn't have said fast talking. I guess I mean like charming. Hustler. Charming.
Yeah. But he'd like, well, I like to make a bet if I could. I mean, I like to make a formal game. But the thing about Billy is like people underestimated how sharp he was early on, but he's as sharp as they come.
Did you have any, like in the movies where it's like at some point the casino's like facial recognition, they're like, don't let this guy bet anymore. You know, take you in the back and bruise you up a little bit. Like, did you ever run into problems with winning too much?
So the way sports betting works, you're not usually betting in the casino. You're betting with, like, back then when I was at my heyday, you were betting with literal, like, street people. So that had, like, corner bookmaking operations. The casinos are for losers and people who can't win. And if you win, they'll just not let you bet anymore. And so you need to find a way to bet on credit through, like, you need to find someone who's going to play a game of telephone with you, who's going to take your bets and then maybe bet more later, or thinks you're a loser, like, or you find a sock, like my big business, like nobody knew who I was. Nobody knew I was winning money betting because I was never the guy making the bets. I'd always find what's called a beard who would make my bets for me. And so I've had numerous beards throughout the years who were making my bets for me, and they were either they were really successful business people or degenerate gamblers or like Hollywood people or like Floyd Mayweather, who's a beard for like half an afternoon for me.
how did that go?
He was too difficult to work with. I mean, he's got so much money and he's
just
not,
like, impulsive.
Like, a dude been hit in the head for like most of his life. Like, you know, he's how much.
He just piggybacked off your bets. Right? He's a huge bankroll. Couldn't he have just piggybacked off your bet? You're telling him to go bet.
I think Floyd was already moving for someone else, whether it was Billy Walters or someone. Like, for sure, someone got into Floyd and Floyd making those bets. Like, nobody posts their bets on Instagram for millions and millions of dollars unless there's an angle, whether they're sponsored by the casino or they're. So, yeah, I think he was moving money for someone, but someone introduced. I sat next to him at a Miami Heat playoff game and he liked the. My friend who was sitting next to me took a liking to her. And so they became friends. And so we somehow had a situation where for an afternoon, him and the guy, his business guy and I were talking and Floyd was going to make the bets, but it just didn't work. Like, I told him I wanted to bet one game and they said, no, we like the other side. And I was like, that's cool, but can you please go bet this one for me? And they're like, no, we don't want to do that. Like, you know, we want to bet the other side. And I was like, okay, well then we'll just bet against each other. You bet that side, I'll bet this side. And they're like, no, but you always win. We can't do that. And I was just like, yeah, I'm out. I can't deal with this anymore. So that was it. So.
Is the motivation on all this getting rich, or is it getting a rush? Is it an intellectual challenge? What's the what's the motivation?
Not a rush. No, the rush is like, I'm not a rush guy. It's I think it's the intellectual challenge. Also, I've realized as I've gotten older that I take pride in putting myself in really, really stressful situations and seeing how well I perform. Like that's like probably a weakness of mine is I'll put myself in these really stressful situations without knowing it, but I'll do that.
What's an example of that?
Like being all in Bitcoin since 2013, like for 160 to 170% of your net worth at various different points in time.
160, so you borrowed?
Yeah. So betting on sports and making money was challenging. And in terms of your winning money, like I was living in Canada at the time, I was betting all over the world and having to receive money from people all over the world. And so my bank accounts were constantly getting closed. Even in Canada, I was like, I'm a professional gambler. This is what I do. I pay my taxes as a professional gambler. It's one of the few dummies in Canada who actually, because in Canada, tax gambling is considered non-taxable. So I was like one of the few people who actually paid tax on their gambling winnings in Canada because I was considered an expert. But I didn't have to, but I did that. Probably stupid on my part. So just that. And then seeing how easy it was to move money with Bitcoin. And then the other part of it was later on in life, I left Canada after I got tired of paying taxes in Canada, and I moved to Monaco. And that entire principality is built on minimizing your tax exposure. It's you know, you're looking at flats that are like the current places in Monaco now that just got built are $85, $90 million for a 3,000 square foot condo. It's the most expensive real estate in the world. And the only reason it's that expensive is because there's a limited amount of land and everyone lives there because the tax is zero tax. And so my point is that's like a Swiss bank account move. People are willing, but whereas there's a lot of people, whereas Bitcoin, you don't have to invest in Monaco real estate to hedge. You can have your money in your pocket. You don't have to worry about a bank. You can move money without any intermediates, without any permission. Even the bank accounts I had, whether they be in Monaco or Canada, they'd always been like, why are you sending this money? Where is it going? Why did you get it? And now it's even worse. So that was part of it. I like the math behind it. It made sense to me as a math guy. And I'm an independent guy to begin with. And so it didn't really click for me until later on. I heard about it maybe 5 or 6 times before it finally clicked. It finally clicked because I was betting with someone in China who had a really difficult time in paying me money. Also, I was living in Vancouver before I moved and my entire apartment building was owned by Chinese expats who were literally laundering their money in Canadian real estate. None of them lived in my building. The entire building was empty except for 6 people, but the entire building was sold. And all of Vancouver, if you've ever been to Vancouver, Canada, it's an entire money laundering operation. The real estate is all owned by foreign people trying to escape regimes that are, you know, they're just capital flight. So Bitcoin just made sense. Okay, I'm going to go buy a condo in Canada, or I'm going to buy some Bitcoin and put it in my wallet to escape some capital flight.
So were you taking the $10 million gross earnings and just going straight to Bitcoin?
No, then I was trying to get paid by people who owed me money. And so the first time I ever acquired Bitcoin, I had a gentleman in fellow that I met playing poker, who got me a bunch of accounts in China to bet on NBA basketball or Asia, let's say. I don't know where it was exactly, but somewhere. And he was like, it was 2013-ish. And I was like, hey, like, how are you going to send me money? At some point we had like an HSBC account in Hong Kong. And he's like, I can send you Bitcoin. And I was like, Bitcoin, really? You guys like Bitcoin? I think the price was around $180 at the time. He's like, yeah, everyone in China loves Bitcoin. And I was just like, well, if everyone in China loves Bitcoin, maybe I should love Bitcoin too. Like, why do they love it in China? And he's like explaining to why everyone loves it and how great it is. And so that was it. So I bought it. Then it very quickly went to 600, then 1,000, like very after. And then it slowly went down to about 150 after, I think, Bitfinex got hacked after that the next summer. But that's when I got involved. And it clicked for me instantly. When I was all the situations, moving to Monaco for taxes, seeing my all of the real estate in Canada being super expensive for native Canadians, especially in Vancouver, because of especially people from Asia buying real estate and just holding it and not doing anything with it. And I just like, why would you, like Michael Saylor now has a really good view on it. It's like, why would you ever own real estate? You're at the mercy of the government who can change the rules and change the taxes, or you could just buy Bitcoin. So that was it, basically.
When you're dealing with, you know, I'm not saying that you're shady or you do ever do anything illegal, but when gambling as an outsider, when I hear about gambling, I watched the movie Casino and I think of mafia and whatever. Yeah. When you're owed money, and I had read stories how you were owed money and you talked about it, what's up with the gambling culture? Do people actually pay their debts or just on a handshake agreement?
I mean, I think I had an advantage. I mean, just to be clear, like I lived in Canada, gambling was legal. I paid my taxes. I wasn't doing anything illegal. Some of the people who I'm, my customers are all breaking the law because they're bookmakers. So I'm not the customer. I'm the sharp. They're the sucker. I'm winning the money. They may think that I'm the customer, but really I'm not. So for me, the hard part was like, okay, Revenue Canada wants 57% of my money as my partner, but they're putting all my customers out of business by making it hard. So that was part of it. To answer your question, is it hard to get paid? Yeah, people lose money. Because I'm betting through intermediaries for the most part, I think like part of the deal is you have to guarantee the money when you're making the bets. And people would go out of their way to guarantee me, not because they're afraid of me, because why would they be? I've never ever done anything to get money other than be like annoying. But like if you knew that I was always going to win, and if you didn't pay me, you knew you were not going to get my bets anymore, you might go out of pocket to make sure your relationship with me was good, knowing that eventually you're going to make the money back if you're smart enough. If you're smart enough, you'd realize, why would I stiff Haralabos? Haralabos is going to win. We're going to win it back next year. I'll go out of pocket. We'll figure out a solution. That's generally what happened with me.
That's a good threat, though. You look, I'm going to call you like at least 5 or 6 times to get paid.
I was pretty bad at it, to be honest. Like the way to get paid is to be the most annoying person in that person's life. So I had a famous poker player who's like a really good dude, but he was for sure a degenerate and he owed me money. And not this guy, Eric Lindgren, he talked,
that's what I was referring to. Yeah.
Yeah. And if he won a tournament, I would like get on a plane and just like be there when they paid him. I would just like hand out and just like, you just gotta, you know, but you also have to be like, kind of like understanding that this guy needs to live his life and also have some money. But you know, he was a guy who at the time owned a piece of Full Tilt. So they had all this imaginary money that they thought they were all gonna be so rich. And so he didn't really worry, you know, you didn't really worry about getting paid because he thought eventually they'd get paid by Full Tilt Poker, but then Full Tilt Poker got shut down. So all these guys, yeah. Anyways, yeah, that's what you do. You just be annoying.
What inspired you to buy the soccer team? So like how long had you had that idea before you end up doing it?
I wanted to buy an NBA team. And then I saw like the sausage was made and I was like, yeah, the NBA is not for me.
What do you mean by that? Why not?
I mean, for one, the franchise valuations are going up and up and up and up. It's a very, very, very difficult business to buy because you're competing with the richest people in the world who want these assets. So it's very difficult. And then I started finding the sport not that interesting anymore after seeing like how everything was, I think the bubble for me kind of ended it because it was during that time when the league became like, which is cool because the league was primarily, it became like almost like a social cause versus, and I thought that's good for society in some ways if you believe that. But for me, it just became too much. I just want sport. I just like sport. So around that time, I think where the NBA maybe missed things is I think a lot of people wanted to escape during coronavirus into sport. Forget about other people. I wanted to escape the shitty, the whatever, the riots, the burn, the whatever. I wanted to escape all that into sport. And I'm watching the NBA and it's, and maybe the answer isn't escape for people who are, I'm not American, but maybe for Americans who are living through it and they really believe that, whatever, that's cool. But for me, I was just like, yeah, I don't want to watch this. Like, I want to watch a basketball game. I don't want to have like a message. And so, yeah, it became too much, I think, in some ways. It became overwhelming. And then also I was working for the Mavericks at the same time and they were in the bubble and I'm hearing the stories from them. And you have like African-American coaches who are like really upset with what's happening, as they should be. The players are upset. It just became like really draining emotionally in a way that made me really kind of sad. And I started watching football more because soccer was the first sport to start up after COVID. And so I just got really into it. And we were already building models to begin with before then. I thought, you know what? This is new. It's exciting. It's more mathematical in the sense of it's unsolved. It's a lot more. There's a lot. The game tree is bigger. It's more nuanced. Basketball is pretty simple. You get a top five player. You put him on the court. You surround him with other players, but he's the guy. It's called heliocentrism. And then you profit. And then you trade him for Anthony Davis and one first. I don't know. But that's it. You just find a guy like Luka or LeBron or Jokic or whatever. And off you go. But not that difficult.
New York City founders, if you've listened to My First Million before, you know I've got this company called Hampton. And Hampton is a community for founders and CEOs. A lot of the stories and ideas that I get for this podcast, I actually got it from people who I met in Hampton. We have this big community of 1,000+ people, and it's amazing. But the main part is this 8-person core group that becomes your board of advisors for your life and for your business, and it's life-changing. Now, to the folks in New York City, I'm building a in real life core group in New York City. And so if you meet one of the following criteria, your business either does $3 million in revenue, or you've raised $3 million in funding, or you've started and sold a company for at least $10 million, then you are eligible to apply. So go to joinhampton.com and apply. I'm going to be reviewing all of the applications myself. So put that you heard about this on MFM so I know to give you a little extra love. Now back to the show. You said we. You said we are building models. I think Sean and I were talking, and he was like, "This guy's like a lone wolf." And I don't know the truth, and I want you to tell me the truth. Do you? I think you don't have a family. I think and I think that, like, from an outside perspective, it doesn't seem like you have this massive company. Like, what?
That part, I'm a lone wolf. Yeah. Okay. This now I am a lone wolf. When you put it that way, yeah. Like, I've always been very. But I have people who work for me. I have people who help me build my model.
Can you explain that? Yeah. What's the organization?
What's your team look like?
I have had now my organization, not counting the football team, which is completely separate, which is like 250 people or something worked for me. I don't know how many it is. It's a lot. Maybe less. I don't know. Account academy players. I still do my basketball betting. I spend zero time on it. It's an automated program. But when I first started betting on basketball programmatically with a model, when I decided that my method works, but it only works if my mindset is good, if I want to have a life and have like emotional relationships with females and have a partnership, whatever, and I'm upset, I'm making bad decisions when I'm gambling, it's harder to be like a perfect arbiter of what's right and what's wrong and what's the right information when you're the input. So I wanted to automate me, basically. And so, I hired a couple different quants unsuccessfully. They weren't great. Kept trying. And then a friend of mine, a poker player by the name of, he played poker. This guy named Brandon Adams was teaching at Harvard at the time. And I was playing poker with him. Really, really smart guy. And he said, "I have this student that I think you need to talk to. He's a genius and he'd be perfect." And I met him. And that was the guy who basically, together, we built our simulation models that really took me to the next level, which was not the halftime thing, which I made a lot of money on. This was now full game bets on, sides, totals, everything. And so him and I together built. And our operation was myself, this individual, and then one person who basically was two people who were putting the bets in and also making the lineups. And then me and we call him the Wiz because he doesn't want to be, nobody wants to know who he is, but he's out there. What's up? And we had a falling out. When I went to go work for the Mavs, I basically turned over the business to them. And he ran it for a while, didn't enjoy it. They didn't do that well. And he left. And then when I quit the Mavs, we started back up again. And that was it. So I basically did the gambling again. Not for myself, but for the people who worked for me to allow them to continue to make a lot of money. Because I've had guys who've worked for me now for over 12 or 13 years with a gap period in the Mavericks. And so they run everything and they do everything.
Dude, you're basically running it like a small little seed fund, Sean. You know what I mean?
Like a hedge fund.
Algorithmic hedge fund, like jump minus, you know.
So, you know, those guys, they measure their success on, you know, IRR or, you know, annual returns. And if they could get 20%, 30% returns, what's a good annual return for you? What's a bad annual return for you? Where do you land? You know, I know what multifamily can get you. I know what private equity can get you. I know what venture can get you.
It's hard to really quantify because I'm never able to bet my entire network. Like, I can't take in outside capital. And so, like, I don't look at it as more like an annual ARR it's more of a return on investment on every bet you're making. And so every bet we make, a bad year for us was 4 to 4.5% on every bet we're making. A good year is like in the 8s and 9s. And now, of course, you want to have as many bets as possible and the most profit as possible. So you want your ROI to go down a little bit as your bets go up. So it's like you're threading the needle. But the game has changed so much now that now we've got like two models that are going at all times. And we use like a mix between the two of them. And when I say it's automated, it's completely automated. Like zero, last 4 or 5 years since even before I, you know, even when these guys are running it themselves, like nobody's saying, oh, I think the model's wrong. Like it gets teams wrong for sure. And we have a guy who says like, yeah, we're really off on these Oklahoma City totals. Like we think they should be higher scoring, but they're not. We think they'd be lower score. We think they're higher scoring, but they're going under. And I'm just like, cool. We're not making any changes. Like run with the model.
And has, you know, now, like we said this before, I don't pay attention too much to sports, but I think it's fucking insane, though, that, like, every sport is basically a gambling thing now. Like, it's, like...
It's gross.
I think it's weird. But...
It's not weird, it's gross. It's
it's messed up. I think it's wrong. And, but does that make you richer, then, because you have more retail investors?
Yeah, the amount of... I don't even look, like, last night, like, I probably lost more money on Fartcoin yesterday. My fart coin holding on paper than I would rate to make in an entire year betting NBA. So I don't care what we make in the NBA. I just do it because it's meaningful for the people who work for me and they have a massive profit share in it. So that's why we do it.
So let me just recap a couple of things. You said if every bet, you know, low end 4 or 5%, good 9-10%, that means you need to bet like $100 million of total betting volume, total dollars bet to make 10 million. Is that
correct?
Right?
Yeah. Well, you don't need 100 million to do that because you're doing it every day, multiple times over. And so, like that's exactly right. Yeah.
So couldn't you have just applied your brain to like buying HVAC companies as like private equity and gotten better returns, right? Like, you know, like I always think about this with like, if I hear somebody's a pro blackjack player, I'm like, first of all, I don't even know if that's technically a thing. I don't know if blackjack is like a game you can get an edge in anymore. But secondly, if you're that good and that smart, like, couldn't you just apply it to an easier game and made more money? Like, don't you think about that for yourself?
Yeah, if my dad was Ray Dalio, I probably would have went a different path. But unfortunately, my dad was my dad was a Greek gambler who spent his time at the racetrack. So this is what I knew. You know, I don't know what else to say.
But you have done it. You have done it, right? You're buying a team. That seems like it could be a great business move. And you did crypto.
Yeah, the crypto thing is really the part I think that is because I don't have an edge in finance. These people have bigger, they're smarter. Like maybe I could have honed in on one specific category that I knew very well. But again, like I try to, like I'm a gambler in the sense that I like gambling games, but like the number one edge in poker is playing with players who are worse than you. That's just it. And so I try to apply that also to my businesses. I try to stay away from people that are smarter than me, where there's plenty of them. In terms of that I'm competing against. And so, yeah, I mean, am I going to compete with like, no, I don't think so. I mean, maybe, but at this point, I think I'm good at what I'm doing. I like my quality of life.
Well, what do you do with your money now? Do you like your income or your investments? Do you do any boring stuff? I mean, I mostly do boring stuff, index funds.
Yeah, I do super boring. I do super boring stuff. Every dollar I earn goes directly into Bitcoin. That's my boring stuff.
That's still how you roll then?
Correct. Yeah.
Wow.
Every dollar I make betting sports goes into Bitcoin. Has forever.
So you've made Bitcoin. More money off Bitcoin than you have sports betting.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
I've done very well with Bitcoin. I've done very well. But, you know.
What's your end game with Bitcoin? Is it hold forever? Is it Bitcoin becomes global, you know, reserve currency? Like, where does it, there's no exit with Bitcoin, right, for you?
don't know. I wish I could do better Michael Saylor impersonation, but I don't know. This guy, I like this guy. I feel like his end game, as crazy as this guy is, I feel like he's kind of, he's a savant. Like, he's kind of figured, what is your end game? I don't know, dollars? What am I going to do with dollars? Like, sorry, I'm not, they're printing more of it. Like, it's not, it doesn't seem like it works for me. I remember, like, being in COVID, living in Malibu during COVID, and the houses that I rented had gone up in value, like, triple. Like, rich people's stuff was going, becoming more and more expensive as more and more money entered the system. So what's my end game? I don't know. Protect my wealth, I guess. Maintain my sovereignty. That's my end game. I don't know. Like, I just, to be clear, I don't have it in, I like Bitcoin, but it's still, I'm not like the pure Bitcoin guys, like the guys who are like, have their own seed and they have it memorized in their head. Like, that's not me. My money's in iBit. It's in the bank. It's with a third party. It's not smart, but I like my quality of life. I don't want to be my own bank. Like, being my own bank was cool before people knew what crypto was. Now being your own bank is not cool. Like, for me, just to be clear, like, I love Bitcoin. I love the self-sovereignty of it. That's the ethos. But my money is custodied with institutions, unfortunately.
Do you own anything? Like, do you own any real estate and cars and like items, or do you live light?
Yeah. Dude, like, this guy, I feel like a lot of this guy thinks I'm like some kind of like, I'm like an alien who just dropped into the world that has nothing.
Well, you
buys Bitcoin and watches sports all day.
Shard and I actually both rent homes, and I don't. Yeah. I actually don't own a lot of stuff. I like living light. Shard does too. We don't actually own houses. We like to rent houses.
So recently, I was with you guys, and I didn't own any real estate. Like, I bought real estate when I was younger. I didn't before that. I just thought like the better move is Bitcoin than. Like, why am I going to buy this house in Malibu when I can rent and buy Bitcoin? I also sold all of my assets during the 2017 dump. I own property in Mexico. I had some vacation property. I had some property in Europe. I had a plane, sold it all. Actually had some friends try to schedule an intervention for me because they thought I'd lost my mind when I sold everything to buy more Bitcoin at $3,300.
You sold all your shit to buy the dip? That's incredible. That's amazing. I got to ask you a different question. What are you into now? Like, we asked you a bunch about the past, but like, what's the future shit you're really, like, somebody said you're into biohacking or you're into
that. Sam mentioned something interesting about like owning things and no, I'm just kidding. What am I into now? I'm into biohacking. I'm into, I don't know. Like, I think like I'm into, it's interesting because I'm really into like analog things, like records, books, old games, old like pinball machines.
Yeah.
I'm into horses.
Are you like detoxing from phone? Like, phone goes away for hours a day?
Yeah, I'm
something?
Getting this new, I forget what it's called, but this new thing that's black and white. I'm trying to.
What's it called?
I'm into that. I think Obox is the new one that just came out. Palma 2, I think, is what it is. It's supposed to be getting shipped. But looks really cool.
We love those things. I use the brick all the time. And then there's like Daylight, which is like another, like dumb phones, basically.
Daylight's nice. I've used Daylight.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm into that. I'm into like, to be honest, like during COVID, I started getting into like Western life. Like, this is going to sound crazy, but like I want a ranch.
Yeah, and Sam bought a ranch.
I bought a ranch, my friend. Do you want to be buddies? Like,
I would love to. I bought a yacht before. It was like on the Mediterranean cruising. And now I'm like, no, I want a ranch. I want horses. I want simple life. So that's what I'm into.
What are you doing for biohacking? Like what's your kind of like, what are you finding valuable or helpful or you're
best
seeing
thing, the best thing?
Of?
Yeah. I do a lot of peptide stuff. I kind of grew up in like, I spent a lot of time, I should say, in like rich guy LA circles for a minute playing poker, and all these guys were on like TRT and HGH and all this other stuff. And they looked great, but they weren't necessarily optimizing for living longer. So HGH is great. You feel awesome on it, but you're definitely not living longer taking it. TRT, I think, can be good for some people. It didn't work for me. I tried it. It made me irritable. So I do other things to raise my testosterone. Like, I take some Rodacea, whatever, and Fidocia Artesis, and I do a lot of squats and kettlebell stuff. And so I do quite well with that. But what am I taking? I'm taking peptides for the most part. I think the best thing I've ever done, I do a lot of sauna, red light therapy. I would say the best thing.
That Brian Johnson regimen.
I mean, I admire what he's doing. I just think like, he's doing it for science, I guess. But for me, not for me. I'm not that bad. But I do take about 20 supplements a day for sure.
I inject myself with some peptides when I'm diligent about it. But I think the best thing I've ever done was stem cells.
Are you doing peptides and stem cells for injury recovery, or you're doing I thought peptides is like for injury recovery. Do you use it for other stuff?
A peptide's like a protein, yeah? Like, or an amino acid, I guess, which is a precursor to protein.
Yeah, it's a precursor. You can find a peptide, it's a precursor for whatever you want to solve for. So like some is for injury recovery, like DPC-157.
That's what I took that on my Achilles. It was great.
Yeah, that also helps with your gut, which then your gut connects to your brain, which helps your brain. It helps you. There's a lot of benefits to it. I take Hesamorelin, Epamorelin, Hexarelin. With a doctor, I get tested very regularly, my blood tested very, very regularly. But the best thing I've ever done, and the thing I could recommend to anyone who can afford it, is, aside from sauna, five times a week, is stem cells, getting actual stem cells that are mesenchymal, which is through the umbilical cord.
Do you do that if you have an injury, or like, I feel great. Like, were you in pain?
You look great. So you're probably, yeah. You look great. Both of you guys look like, I'm not sure how, but you guys look like you're doing great stuff for your health. But I think, people do it for injury. I did it because I wanted to feel better. And I found this place in Panama that I went to, Stem Cell Institute. And they were kind of one of the pioneers behind it. Dr. Riordan. I think Mel Gibson's dad may have talked about this on the Joe Rogan show. I'd already gone there, but I think there's like an episode where Mel Gibson talks about his dad going there to get stem cells. I've seen similar things. Like, it's unbelievable.
Is this the one where it's like its own sovereign land?
No, I don't know what that is, but this is just Panama. You're at, like, you stayed at Hilton. Last time, I don't think it was sovereign. I know what you're talking about. I do know what you're talking about. No, it's nothing like that.
Aren't they doing genetic? They're doing genetic. Yes. What's it called? Were you?
CRISPR.
Yeah, they're doing that, CRISPR. Right? It's like a Peter Thiel thing.
Genome editing. They're doing genome editing. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't want none of that. I just want building blocks into my body to make me young. So if you can give me the stuff that little baby has to grow a fucking actual human.
Wait,
being.
But what are these guys doing? It's like their own little sovereign area, and they're like building like the future Yao Ming super baby or something.
You know, like the network state stuff, right? Where it's basically like, oh, if we can get, like, you know, I invest in Praxis. It's like people want to create new land where they can have, like, you know, let's say more, they can have different rules, right, for themselves.
And yeah, so, it's like a land where like Ayn Rand is the president, you know, like libertarian land.
You got to watch the documentary. It's hilarious because Brian goes there. I think he goes there for like a full plasma like swap with his son and his dad or something like that. I don't remember exact procedure he did, but he goes and it's like the two scientists who created this institute. And they show the guy, and the guy's clearly like 22 years old. He's so young. But he has this mustache and he has glasses with like a rope, as if like, bro, we can see through the disguise. You're 22 years old. and the narrator.
Was he standing on another kid's shoulders with a trench coat on?
Exactly. It literally looked like that. And he's like, you know, I think these guys' hearts are the right place, but, you know, they're not like 20-year PhDs, if you know what I mean. It's like, yeah, because he's 20. It was so funny. You got to watch that part.
Yeah, I actually did watch it, and I know what you're talking about now. And I remember, like, I had my finger, this is where I need my digital whatever, but I had my finger on the fast forward the entire time. I'm like, because you can't watch it all the way through. It's just like, this is not that interesting. But yeah, I do know what you're talking about now. Yeah, it's nothing like that. This is more for, you have a rotator cuff injury. Some parents were there with some kids who were autistic, and they were doing that therapy. It was people with MS. There's a lot of different stuff that they were doing. And I had the most, I've done it maybe 7 times. The injuries you have will repair permanent. That's permanent. The Superman feeling you have for 3 to 4 months, afterwards is fleeting, but it feels amazing for that 2 or 3 month period. And there's a lot of physiological effects that you know that you got a good batch. Sometimes you don't get a good batch or it doesn't take, but if you had a good batch, you'll know it. And it's great. I haven't done it in a while, but it is amazing.
Do you do any drugs or drink alcohol? Do you get like fucked up at all?
No.
Are you sober?
Yeah, I've just never, I think the last time I ever got, I mean, I was betting on NFL football and Canadian football in university and waking up with a hangover. And I was like, yeah, this doesn't work.
So you've been in like this like vice, this world, a world of vice, but not substances and like
I'm a control. I like to be in control of myself. I like to be in control of my emotions. I like to be making good decisions. I don't like to be unable to think rationally. So alcohol doesn't do it for me.
Dude, this is great. Thanks for doing this, man. Where should people follow you? Is Twitter still the best place, or X?
Yeah, I mean, follow the football club. I'm not looking to promote myself, but I would love for the football club to get more. You know, we were doing some great things this year at the football club. And then
you guys won, right? You won the, like,
we were recently promoted to La Liga 2. We had an amazing first start of the season. And then we had a game. We had a stretch where we played 22 games in 6 days. And I failed the culture in that I wasn't able to demand that we do things that were proper for rest and health for the players. And we ran our players into the ground during that period because I didn't have, you know, that was something that the coaches wanted to do. And then we suffered some injuries. And we've been basically, we're in the midst of a 6-game losing streak right now, which is sad. And we're paying for it from what we did in November, which was a cultural failure on my part. So
Are you able to apply the biohacking shit that you're learning to your sports psychology?
Not in the medicine part of it, but like there's lots of studies on how to optimize health and what the your risk of muscle injury goes up 25% if a football player plays more than one game every 6 days. There's plenty of research that can make you come to good decisions.
But like sleep and recovery.
We're going to do a better job. When I bought the team, we didn't even have a training facility. So we're building a brand new training facility. We hope to announce the land that we've acquired soon. We'll do stuff like that.
Did you think that you were going to go from like doing these bets and hanging out with your dad in Vegas to owning a team and implementing like whatever you want to implement? That's pretty wild, right? That's a good ending so far. Or it's not the end, but yeah, it's a good part of the story.
You did think that.
You thought that.
I did. I was very delusional when I was younger. I was very like, I'm really a big fan of that sort of stuff. Like speaking things, not speaking into, but just like having the belief and why not? Why not? I mean, I don't know, the universe is kind of there for you. Do it like you can craft your own path. Just keep trying until you get there.
Dude, you're insane. You're the man.
Awesome.
You're the man.
Thanks for coming on, dude.
You're welcome.
Well, thank you, man. That's it. That's the pod.
I feel like I can rule the world. I know I could be what I want to. I put my all in it like no days off. On the road, let's travel, never looking back.
Hey everyone, a quick break. My favorite podcast guest on My First Million is Dharmesh. Dharmesh founded HubSpot. He's a billionaire. He's one of my favorite entrepreneurs on earth. And on one of our podcasts recently, he said the most valuable skill that anyone could have when it comes to making money in business is copywriting. And when I say copywriting, what I mean is writing words that get people to take action. And I agree, by the way, I learned how to be a copywriter in my 20s. It completely changed my life. I ended up starting and selling a company for tens of millions of dollars. And copywriting was the skill that made all of that happen. And the way that I learned how to copywrite is by using a technique called copywork, which is basically taking the best sales letters and I would write it word for word and I would make notes as to why each phrase was impactful and effective. And a lot of people have been asking me about copywork, so I decided to make a whole program for it. It's called Copy That. CopyThat.com. It's only like $120 and it's a simple, fast, easy way to improve your copywriting. And so if you're interested, you need to check it out. It's called Copy That. You can check it out at copythat.com.